Well, you just never know what you're going to get on DH Radio. And that actually almost goes for me included. And sometimes what that has to do with is finding out what's happening in the Eastern Townships. And one of the things going on currently is the Living Libraries exhibition and events that are taking place at the Forman Art Gallery on campus at Bishop's University. With us in studio right now, and actually who will be presenting this evening at Bishop's University, is Michael Ridley, who is, now I'm going to look at your business card to be very specific about this, Chief Information Officer and Chief Librarian of the University of Guelph. Welcome to DH Radio and CJMQ.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Now, Michael, your expertise and the reason that you've come here, it's kind of interesting. There's like an interesting marrying of information. There are these living books that are going to be at the Forman Art Gallery in the form of these different people who have different skills where groups are going to be able to come in and speak with them. And your expertise has a lot to do with the transmission and the what is going on with information and literacy in books today. So tell me about what you're finding is the case.
The Living Library event, which is so cool, really is a kind of an example of where that's going.
Yeah.
We're moving from libraries that are about books and resources and things to libraries that are about people and how they can interact and exchange information and really discover each other almost on an intimate way. The way the Living Library works, which is really quite wonderful, is people just sit down and open up with each other and learn about things directly. So if you think about that as a kind of a next step on how people will exchange information at a very personal level, I kind of take that to the wacko fringe, if I could put it that way.
I love the wacko fringe. Go there.
You'll love this. So so if really what's happening is we're evolving in very different ways and we're learning to communicate differently, where might that go? And that's what I'm going to talk about this evening, actually. Explore that outer limit piece of what's going to happen with literacy. And my basic premise is that as much as literacy is an important, powerful thing about humans, and the alphabet's a wonderful discovery, it's just a tool. It's a tool we invented. And the idea is we'll invent another tool, a different tool, that will likely displace reading and writing. So what I'm really going to tell people is that literacy is dead. Literacy is toast. It's over. That there's something else coming, and that something else is going to be so powerful and so positive that we won't care that we don't read and write anymore because we're doing something else. And I call that post-literacy, and the post-literate world is not a new dark age. It's not a terrible place that we don't want to go to. It's actually a very positive and welcoming environment where we'll have that intimacy and that knowledge and that understanding that Living Library is really maybe the leading edge of.
So in this evolution, I'm sure that what part of it is, like, hearing that is scary. Like, the idea of literacy being dead.
And as a librarian, I'm probably going to get kicked out of the profession for saying this, Sheila. So, you may be responsible for my professional downfall when you air this.
But... Oh, geez. Well, you know what? I was a librarian the last 4 years, too, so I can kind of... sort of know where you're coming from. And yet, at the same time, when I think of my own experiences in a high school library for the last 4 years, what I saw was that people wanted to be there. It's not that they didn't want to be there, and they wanted to exchange information and they needed to do research there and all that sort of thing, except that quite often where they got the information from was what wound up being different. So it was more about that there needed to be resourceful people in that place, and there was some documentation that was important that was found in books, but a lot of it was coming from elsewhere, from professionals, from the internet, from
the sources of information are far broader than ever before. I mean, the old days of sitting down in the library reading a couple of books and that was your research, or reading some journal articles, still important. Not to denigrate that is not important, but now we get so much more information from each other, from other kinds of media. I mean, think about the increase in visual literacy,
mm-hmm.
or the increase in oral literacy, in a sense of being able to exchange information in very different ways like that. So it's about not preferencing one kind of media or one kind of resource. It's about understanding there are many resources. And the trick, and I, you know, as a former high school librarian, you'll get this. The trick is, how skillful are you in using that information? How can you sift the good stuff from the not so good stuff? How can you bring information together from different sources and really understand it, as opposed to simply memorizing it and regurgitating it? And if, you know, if libraries are anything, they're about self-awareness and about that skill set in synthesizing information and really understanding what's going on, not in a superficial way, but in fact in a critical and a critically appraised way. That's what libraries are about.
So one of the things that strikes me in that idea is, and the use of these skills and that the synthesis is, I'm thinking of the people who perhaps are less comfortable with interacting with other individuals, who sure. perhaps sought out a kind of solace or a way of learning or the transmission of knowledge that they felt comfortable with that exists in books and book learning and reading and that sort of thing. Do you think that it will still suit the needs of somebody who's a learner or a person with who has maybe those social challenges?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because I think people do gravitate towards the media that they feel most comfortable with, mm-hmm. whether it's as you say, reading, which is a very solitary experience, or whether it's engaging with a group because they can learn from each other. And we know that people have different learning styles and different approaches, and we need to provide opportunities for all those kinds of styles. But let me press on this just a little bit for fun, because if we go down the post-literacy path as far as I might take it, mm-hmm. so there is no need for reading and writing, we would only get there because the level of connection that we would have with people, with ideas, with concepts, would be so intense and so powerful that we would view reading and writing as clumsy and awkward and unnecessary. That doesn't mean that post-literacy couldn't be private and intense the way that reading is, that same experience, but it would be enabled differently, and it would still allow people to experience information or engage with information in a different way. So I think as the tool set changes, if I could say that,
yes,
that I still think there'll be opportunities for people to engage in ways that are most comfortable with them. Let me give you an example.
Okay, let's hear it.
So if post-literacy, and you got to remember that we're speculating about something that we have no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
This is not simply computers aren't post-literacy. Digital information isn't post-literacy. It's something much further beyond that. Because really, if you look at the internet, for example, the internet is the largest site for literacy ever. I mean, it's all about reading, in fact. It's not about not reading. To specify, there's lots of other media. It's a very literate environment. So we're talking about something different than that. So the classic alternative is telepathy.
Okay.
Hang in there. It's okay.
I'm not afraid. I'm excited. Let's hear it.
Many people believe they're telepathic.
Okay.
And it's a possibility that we're all telepathic. So what if? This is one of those what if mind games, right?
Yeah.
What if we were all telepathic and it's just been sublimated for years because we couldn't handle it. We didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Just imagine.
Or we're afraid of it.
Or afraid of it, mm-hmm. Or you know, lots of reasons, right? And we do know that things have evolved in humans for many years. We've learned skills and adapted in ways that we wouldn't have expected. So let's just postulate for a moment that we're all telepathic. If we could do that and we could manage that telepathy, you and I wouldn't have to be sitting here talking to each other. We would simply know what it is that we're thinking and experiencing. We would do that Vulcan mind meld.
Yes.
Where we would simply understand each other.
Trekkie, so I love that. Okay.
And why not?
Yeah.
I mean, why not have that? We, in exchanging back and forth the way we are now, we're trying to bridge the gap between what you're thinking, what I'm thinking, what I want to tell you, what you want to hear from me. And it's awkward because the language we're using is crude. We're not using words in the same way that we might do it separately. So we're trying to bridge that gap. That's what communication always is.
Yeah.
But what if we didn't have to do that? What if I could simply understand you at an intellectual as well as an emotional level? Wouldn't that be amazing? And then we could understand groups of us. We could understand that sort of general human experience in a way that was visceral but also incredibly intimate. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing? And then wouldn't that say to you, well, I'm not going to talk with you anymore because I don't need to. I know you. You know me. We've got that bonding at that kind of level, which is enormously powerful. So that's the kind of the wacko fringe out there that says, if you could move in that direction, wouldn't that be cool? And wouldn't it be an incredible advance in human understanding?
Absolutely. Now, but then, isn't there a whole set of filters that it would have to go through for every single person based on how they interpret the world? So will they necessarily understand another person, or are they actually understanding the person through their own set of filters?
Well, that's a great experience. I mean, it's a great observation, because it doesn't necessarily mean we'd all be the same.
Okay.
We would all be different, because we'd all have different experiences, and we've gathered those experiences, we've internalized them. So you and I are still going to be different people, but our ability to exchange that difference and bridge those differences would be so much easier, because I'm not having to put it into words where my words are failing to express what I really want to say, and when I do express it, you're failing to understand it the way I want you to.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those sort of things then happen. So it doesn't eliminate the individual. Oh, I want to come back to that, because there is a dark side to all this.
Okay.
But it doesn't eliminate the individual. It just makes the individual more accessible to the other, I think. Let me take it another direction, though, because people get worried about telepathy, because they worry that that's kind of science fiction-y, and all my science friends really are upset with me when I talk too much about telepathy, because they think it wacko fringe stuff.
Yeah.
But think about something that's much more likely and actually is already happening in a very small way. What you know, what is your understanding, your knowledge, is in your brain. It's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in your head encoded in ways that your brain can actually get use of. So when you deconstruct that to its ultimate level, you are your synapses. You are your brain parts. You're the proteins, you're the neurotransmitters, you're the bits and pieces in your brain that actually contain your memory and understanding. So at the end of the day, information and knowledge is physiological. It's constructed in your head.
Okay.
No magic, it's no weird stuff. It is actually all about proteins and neurotransmitters, the stuff we know more and more and more about. So if information is physical, if information has that physicality, maybe I could synthesize it. Maybe I could say, gee, what I'd really like to, and especially right now, what I'd really like to be able to do is speak French.
Okay.
So let me take a pill, and the pill will grow my understanding of French in my brain. It will replicate, it will synthesize the chemical structures, the physical structures of a French-speaking person.
Oh my goodness!
And why not? I mean, my understanding, you know, if you do speak French, your brain has a vocabulary, it has a grammar, and it's structured around it, knows how to use those tools, and you're literally constructed to be able to speak French.
Et je parle en français.
Voilà. So, if I want to learn French, and we can synthesize what it is to understand French and speak French, then why not simply ingest it? So it becomes neural pharmacology.
It's like ingestion of information?
Right.
Wow.
So it's not so wacko, because when you think about what's going on right now with pharmacology, psychopharmacology in particular, we've got lots of drugs we now use to do certain things to the brain. So even at a very crude level, something like Ritalin, for example, is used to enhance certain aspects of brain function in order to create better awareness and deal with things like ADD. But what it's doing is it's synthetically changing the way your brain is structured or the way your brain works for a period of time, at least. All I'm doing is extrapolating out probably way too far to say, well, if we can do this, if we know this, and we will know more about this, then at the end of the day, we can create information synthetically, and rather than have to learn it the way we do now through either reading or watching or seeing or hearing, we can simply acquire information in a pharmacological way as opposed to what we do now.
It's funny because I'm sitting here slack-jawed thinking about the magnitude of this sort of thing. Like I was just thinking as you were speaking, well, what would be the thing that I would want to learn? And I love to sing, but I don't play an instrument. So I was thinking, you know, okay, so I decide that I want to be able to play piano. And so I'm imagining that ingesting the pharmacological element that will make my brain work in such a way, or that I will adapt to be able to play piano, and then I'm imagining it wearing off.
Well, it could. I mean, that's a great idea, because if you think about memory, and what we're always talking about here is pretty much memory. Right?
Yeah.
That's the physical construct. Your memories change all the time.
Yes.
So what you remember now isn't actually what happened necessarily. It's your recreation of what happened because you remember it. Every time you remember something, you actually store it differently.
So if you imagine, say, five people are at a specific event and witness something, and then it's the five people's interpretations experience, point of view, level of fatigue, whatever, and totally all different the different. So it's a different. It's five different experiences, but then it's not just five different experiences. It's all of the ways that that person is going to remember the situation, things that could trigger the memory, things which might have to do with something that happened before or after the event actually occurred. So the transmission, retention, and then the future state of that information and knowledge is such a...
And so back to your thing about piano, because the same thing will happen. If you don't do anything with that knowledge, your brain is programmed to get rid of it.
Right.
I mean, if it isn't used, it isn't going to be remembered.
No.
And maybe we could devise things that stick it in your memory, but the possibility likely is that you don't play piano, you don't practice, it's going to atrophy. That skill set will go away. Maybe you need some more drugs or something. This is really going to a bad spot.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, that's what you'll have to do. Alternatively, you could simply play piano.
Yeah.
And that in itself would reinforce those skills and build them. And remember that piano playing is a really interesting thing because piano playing is both intellectual, understanding music and understanding the nature of the instrument, but also physical.
Yes.
And so being able to play piano is all about the action and movement, and that's also a learned behavior. It's also a behavior that reinforces other parts of your body. It's not just about your brain. It's about...
Well, that's it. Like the way your muscles develop and the way that your fingers actually even have to... almost like the placement of the musculature of your hands and your arms and what you can actually do with that and how that has to develop over time as well. Like I was just thinking of an amazing pianist that I know named Francine Beaubien. And when Francine plays piano, it's like a dance.
Right.
And so there's that aspect of it of, will that even necessarily be transmitted with that knowledge? What else will come with it? What other...
Well, it's interesting. I mean, physical things are a combination of physical muscles and movement, but also the brain that tells the muscles to do those things. So there's a really nice... being able to dance, you still need to be able to know physically what it means to dance, and that is in your head. And then your body is following the lead, and it's developing the capacity to do it better. But your brain is dancing too.
Yeah.
And so the two kind of go together.
Well, I was just thinking about that. Like, what if you... Okay. I am not built like a ballerina by any stretch of the imagination. I'm a great dancer, though.
Yeah,
so there's the way, like, how will your... It's the whole concept too of how will your brain read what it means to dance or what dance is, even.
Yeah, this is a good question for you as a dancer. You know, when you dance, a lot of what you... I'm a horrible dancer, so I'm not going to be good on this one. But you know, some of it is going on in your head.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Certainly with musicians and music, you get the same sort of thing. It's a very almost internal kind of experience. You go to that zone, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
Where you don't even recognize what's going on around you. You've become so different.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose yourself, I guess, is what I'm going to. And that losing yourself isn't about your body anymore. Your body's almost an automatic pilot at that point.
Yeah.
It's your brain that's taken over. It's your mind that is doing all the heavy lifting now. And your body is just following the lead. You know, it's got its own... It's got its own sense of direction somehow. So, you know, it's a good example of where the more you think about some of those things, the more it retreats into an internal experience.
Right. Oh, it's just...
Anyway, I wanted to tell you something else, though, because...
Bring it on.
Because this, you know, you've got me thinking about bodies now, because...
Okay.
And in terms of where we're going with post-literacy and where we're going as a species, the weakest link in the chain here is our body.
Okay.
That's our biggest single problem. They don't last long enough, right? They wear out too fast. Things go wrong. We die. Right.
Yeah.
And in a very simple-minded way, one of the best ways for us to improve as a species, to learn more, is simply to live longer. If we could live for a couple hundred years, we would know so much more. We'd be so much more capable. But we don't. And so we've got this problem that we've, you know, we've got to pass on another generation, and they have to figure it out. And it's a very inefficient way to pass information.
Right.
So, solution? The solution is stop being human. So one of the other tenets here...
Okay, go.
One of the other tenets here is we have to become post-humans.
So post-literacy, post-humans. Okay, go.
The future of the human is the cyborg.
Wow.
So to overcome the fact that our bodies are simply not built to last long enough, no matter how far medical science might go, maybe a better option is to download ourselves into machines. And then allow those machines to survive the physical part of what we have to deal with and still allow our our understanding, our consciousness, if you will.
Yes.
To continue.
To carry on.
Now, that's maybe, you know, moving into the terrible terrain of immortality.
Yeah.
But it is about the terrain of extending our life in different ways and avoiding a real complex problem, which is that we're not evolving fast enough physically.
Do people really want to live forever?
I don't know. It's a wonderful thing, because if you're a student of Greek literature, there's always wonderful stories about how immortality is actually a curse.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Freddie Mercury singing Who Wants to Live Forever. Yeah. You know, mind you, he was dying and trying to cope with that at the time, too.
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Right? If you could live forever or live for a longer period of time, you would be so much more knowledgeable, so much more capable,
and
so
you
much
become,
contributing.
Do you become, who are you the property of at that point either? Because I was just thinking, that my biggest concern would not be so much that I would continue to live on. It would have more to do with, oh yeah, well, who is it exactly that's going to be looking after my consciousness and my that supposed me that continues on? Because I don't, you know, then what are people going to do with it? Or what is, like, is it even a, is, how can you predict which way you would want to keep learning?
Well, and it's a great question, because ultimately the real question is, who are you?
Yeah.
What defines you?
Now it's the
as
who.
A person? Am I the representation you see in front of you?
Yeah.
You know, wearing the jacket and the tie and the jeans, or am I what's in my head? And that really defines who I am, and that's really the mark of who I am. This is just an artifact that I carry around for a while, but it isn't who I am.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's the way people think about it. I think people do think about themselves in very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But if I wanted to continue longer, is the essence of me my consciousness and my unconsciousness perhaps as well? But is that really the part that is me, is Mike? And the rest of it is trappings. After all, I've changed a lot. I'm 50-odd years old. And in those 50 years, I've gone from a very different human being as a child to an adult. And I'm still me.
Yeah.
But physically, I've changed enormously.
Yeah.
So why not make another big change?
You know, you said your name, and I'm going to remind the listeners that we're talking with Michael Ridley. He's Chief Information Officer and Chief Librarian of the McLaughlin Library, which is at the University of Guelph. So I just wanted to remind you of that.
So
who's been participating?
Send your cards and letters and complaining about the library.
This is great.
Well, when I talk about this sort of stuff, admittedly, a lot of people say, "And you're a librarian?" isn't this sort of counter to your profession?
Yeah, but you know what? I think that's a really big misconception about librarians, is that librarians only have to do with the exchange of books and information. From a place where they're all kept to the people and back again.
Right.
And whereas librarians often, if they have taken interest in that kind of transmission of information, it's because they have a whole other existence and set of interests and that sort of thing.
Well, that's why this whole post-literacy stuff was as wacky and as scary as it is. I actually am not worried about it, because even though it's odd and unusual and certainly, you know, it really does challenge enormously our concept of literacy and how important literacy is to us. But at the end, the reason why I'm not worried about it is that underneath all that is still what I really think is that libraries are all about, which is this idea of being self-aware and developing as an individual, learning and engaging with a human community, with a larger community. All those things, that ability to be critical and thoughtful and understand, is still there.
Yeah.
It's just done differently. And so, you know, it's the library in your head that survives. Maybe not the physical library, at least not the way we know it now. Maybe not even the virtual library, the way we're developing it now with electronic documents.
Yeah.
It's now become an internal thing. And I'm okay about that, because that's the really valuable part about libraries.
I think that as long as creativity and curiosity exists, then what it all has to do with is seeking knowledge and a hunger for knowledge, and that's extremely important and vital, I think.
Well, absolutely. Now we talked earlier about dark sides, because I think this is maybe where one of the dark sides of what I think of as post-literacy might happen. I mean, if you imagine, let's go back to my example of telepathy as a postulate. So let's assume we're all telepathic. We're all sitting here thinking each other's thoughts and understanding them, which is a wonderful possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe intrusive, but wonderful. Presumably you learn how to deal with that.
Okay.
But should we get there, the one dark side is, would we all become like each other? You mentioned it earlier about would we maintain our individuality?
Yeah.
And one possibility is the more we know about each other, the more we might become very much like each other and sort of develop a kind of a collective unconscious. You think about the Borg.
Yes, in Star Trek, right? That was exactly what I thought.
So the Borg is very powerful, but there's a price to be part of the Borg, and that's individuality. You are no longer an individual, you are part of the Borg. So the deal with the devil there is, I'm going to be all-knowing and all-aware, but I'm going to have to give up me to do it. I'm going to have to give up my individuality to get there. So, you know, one of the dark sides here is, are we willing to make that Faustian deal?
Yeah.
Or is our sense of ourselves as individuals so important that we will choose not to have that kind of level of knowledge and understanding?
Or can it be one of those things that is where you choose when, how, and where you do
turn it
so?
Off and on.
Yeah, because one of the things I was thinking of is, I was like, I would wear a tinfoil hat. You know,
now you're starting to denigrate me, Sheila. Come on now.
No, I'm not. I would wear it at the times that I wanted to filter it out, where I would want my privacy, or where I would want, you know. So. Like, does it wind up being one of those things where, okay, well, for part of the time, you're connected, and part of the time you're kind of incognito or AWOL or whatever,
off
the grid. Exactly. Because,
well, you know, I think this is what you're saying is so archetypal of a literate person.
Yes,
because literacy, in lots of ways, literacy created individuals. If you think about pre-literate societies, they were communal societies.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about the individual at all. If you look at Aboriginal society, for example, they didn't have the concept of individual. They didn't have a concept of the individual person.
Yeah.
They had the concept of the group,
yes,
the community.
Mm-hmm.
And individuality was actually a problem, not a unique thing. So literacy, the ability to be literate and to have literacy, actually allowed us to create our sense of individual self.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very modern construct, if you will. And you can't let go of it.
Right?
And you want to keep on it.
So you
want that switch, because you're reluctant to go to a space which would be so different. And I understand that.
Yeah.
That oh my gosh, I'm going to lose something that, while it's relatively new in human experience, we've come to kind of like.
Actually, to tell you the truth, what I'm afraid of losing isn't so much what I know I have. It's the things I don't know that I have. Because the concept that it's got me thinking about is, if I look at my Facebook profile, I'm an avid Facebooker. I connect with people constantly through it. And I think a lot of people think that they know exactly who I am, as long as they see my Facebook profile. But the thing is I have a whole private life and set of interests and experiences that don't occur there. So I was just thinking, you know, part of it has to do with, well, what part of thought is it that winds up being connected? Because if it's the unconscious, like say it's the unconscious mind, I don't know that part of myself.
Right.
So the thing is how comfortable am I, or my subconscious, or, you know, it would mean that we would all have to face who we really are. And I don't know.
We're not so good at that, are
we?
Well,
no, it's not even the facing. If we don't know who we are yet, then do you get to face it first? Because then you have to get to know yourself first. Mm-hmm. If you want to know what is in your unconscious, what is in your subconscious, like, it's a whole.
So this is,
do you share it, or do you get to share it with yourself first?
Well, you know, the answer is who knows. But the interesting thing about the question you're asking is, this is the new frontier for humans, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
This is the part that we don't know a lot about right now. I mean, when I extrapolate about a lot of stuff, I'm talking about neurological discoveries they haven't been made yet, but and may never be made. But we're moving more and more in that direction. We know more and more, for example, about how the unconscious mind works and how much it is working.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing enormous amounts for you. And yet you're not in control of it in that sense. It is literally on automatic pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's controlling an enormous amount of what you and I are doing, even right now. One of the really cool things I'll tell you about with respect to your unconscious mind is something called mirror genes. Genes, these are parts of your brain that essentially emulate the actions of other people. So, for example, I'm now talking to you and I'm waving my hands.
Yes.
My brain is telling me to wave my hands. It's instructing me to do this, and a bunch of neurons are firing off saying, wave his hands, and sure enough, my hands are obeying, which is a good thing. Believe it or not, right now, those same genes, those same neurons are firing in your head too. because you're watching me move my
move,
arm.
And I'm not moving.
You're actually doing it sympathetically in your brain. We know this from imaging, brain imaging, that exactly what I'm doing, you're doing too, except you're not making the motions. So you're emulating what I'm doing. This is the physiological basis for empathy. Right, that's how we are close to each other.
It's like registering
because you're actually doing what I'm doing, except you're not actually making the action in this particular case. It's why we've discovered this recently, when people cry, so when babies cry or when people cry, the other person is neurologically affected. There are actually pheromones that are in those tears that cause me to actually, in this case, to increase dopamine, so that I'm more empathetic with you because you're crying and I'm reacting to that. So there is this incredible level of unconscious communication.
But is that what's going to happen, or are there people where there's something else that's going to surface? Like, is it always that kind of mirror, or can it be that the person, that it actually engages something else in their brain, that maybe it's the reverse of empathy? Maybe when a person sees someone cry, they don't feel empathy, they feel anger.
Right.
So will that happen in some cases?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, they could go all sorts of different directions.
It's like a clown, like a mirror in a carnival.
we're programmed, though, as you can tell, evolutionarily, we're programmed to be sympathetic to people who are crying.
Yeah.
And it turns out that sympathy is not simply experience. It's actually physiological.
Okay.
That empathy is actually causing us to be different.
Is it like the whole concept of one person yawns and then another person yawns?
Perfect example. Okay. Yawning is a perfect example.
That's pretty hardcore.
That one
it's hard to resist.
You actually emulate it.
Yeah.
The other one is it happens, you just don't do it. It happens inside your head as opposed to being something physical like when you yawn.
Yeah.
Which is a good example, though.
Wow.
So again, your original observation was we're going to learn things about ourselves that we don't know at all, and how will that concept of personal, private, and public change as a result of that? Will we become fully public beings? I'm not sure we're ready for that. But how will we be private when what I know might leak out in different ways now, or be available in different
ways? Yes. Wow. It's and you can see the impact that's going to have on a whole on marketing and how actually there will probably be a lot of companies that will exist almost to prey on the fears of people to protect themselves. Like you already see it to a certain extent, but I was just thinking, you know, imagine a big clothing label deciding to come up with a line of protective clothing,
right,
you know,
right,
and then sell it for a ridiculous amount with a Ralph Lauren label on it or something else, you know, like some, mm-hmm, like where it'll be the labeling of safety and privacy.
Right.
Where, you know, like it's
kind of... I've had a discussion with a friend of mine who's a PhD student at University of Victoria, a guy named Chris Parsons, and Chris and I talk about privacy issues, and we've actually come to the point where when we talk about it, we think that privacy might actually be a pathology, not an actual advantage, that trying to be private may ultimately be seen as something that is in the way of human understanding.
Yeah.
So that's a very different way of thinking, but so we think of privacy as a protection of ourself. But maybe if it's seen as, in fact, withdrawing from community or withholding important information, then it becomes more of a pathology than it becomes an advantage to a human.
Wow. That's
that turns the tables on something like that.
Yeah.
There's why people may give... I mean, people give away privacy all the time. You're on Facebook.
Yep.
Every time you're on Facebook, yep, you willingly give away all sorts of information about,
exactly,
yourself. And you do that to your personal advantage.
Yep.
And yet, another aspect of your life, as you said, you're trying to maintain a separation from the rest of the world.
I don't even try. I just do. Yeah. Because it's in my head.
Yeah.
Like when you're talking about it, like to me it's an aspect of I'm only going to give away what I want to, and if I ever feel like whoop, that was maybe a little bit too much, well then I alter then I make an alteration myself. So it's interesting because I was just thinking, well then if it's that whole idea of pathology related to privacy, then there's pathology related to identity. Too.
Yeah, well, there now you're in another interesting turf, aren't you? Because, you know, it's back to what we were talking about earlier, which is how do we decide who we are and what, mm-hmm, we are? What are the markers for that? What are the things that we use to determine what our identity actually is? And particularly now, the ability to have multiple identities, literally.
Mm-hmm.
In a digital world, we can have fully fleshed out avatars mm-hmm. that are completely one different from the other, and even have people experience those avatars in very rich and real ways, one from the other. So you may have, let's imagine a more powerful thing than Facebook, but imagine a Facebook-like environment where you could be a fully fleshed out person in a sense.
Like the holodeck?
Yeah, sure. Go with that.
I'm a Trekkie.
So, you know, that avatar is one representation of who you are or want to be.
Yeah.
But it's different than maybe one that appears somewhere else that you've created in a different way. So, you know, the idea of multiple independent avatars that represent ourselves, our, you know, various aspects of ourselves, is getting very, very close. There's even a wonderful guy, I've forgotten his name now, I wish I could do it. He wrote an article about how there's so much information about ourselves in the net now, mm-hmm. in Facebook or Twitter or blogs or whatever, that and the net knows so much about us that it's real possible that we could continue beyond our physical death, because there's enough information about us that it would keep posting to Twitter, you know, why not? It knows enough about us, it'll just keep posting things.
Yeah.
And, you know, people may not know for years that you've passed on, because your Twitter account's been so active.
It's been giggling.
Because your avatar has been just basically generating tweets in the last couple of years, and probably quite reasonable ones, because it knows a whole lot about you.
Or even just on a really basic level, if you think about automatic replies for emails, or, you know, which already sort of happens, you're not even pressing enter.
Yeah.
Somebody's sending you a message and you responded without responding.
Right.
You know? So, but it's apparently you. And you wrote that message, and you told it to do that, so it's...
So 10 years later, if I know, but Ridley really died 10 years ago, and he's still posting to his blog, you know, what's going on here? But why not? I mean, it's a possibility, right? Because it's information-enabled. It's fueled by what the net, you know, the environment knows about you, and it'll make up stuff which is quite reasonable for you.
That is so interesting and sort of, like, scary and exciting.
I you know, at the end of the day, I think you're absolutely right, which is, you know, what is so fascinating about this is it really does push the boundary of what we think we are and what kind of environment we live in. But, you know, you just have to think, what was it like 150 years ago? And what is it like now? And then what it could be like 150 years from now. And you think, you know, the magnitude of change mm-hmm. is so extraordinary. What we know about the brain now that we didn't know even 10 years ago is extraordinary. It sounds wacko fringe, and it may not happen in our lifetimes, but the trajectory is there.
Yeah.
And if not us, our children or our children's children are going to have to deal with the very questions you've raised about who am I? Or what does it mean to be a human? What does it mean to know and to interact? And it won't be the way that we do it. It won't be the way our, you know, our grandparents or our parents did it. It'll be different.
And it's the whole idea, too. Now we have to question, well, what is the most organic and natural way to be? Michael Ridley,
there's
thank
a prejudice,
you so
by the way.
Much.
There's a prejudice.
Oh, let's hear it.
That it's organic. You
know, yeah. Well, that's it. What it is? That's why I said,
maybe,
what is?
Yeah, maybe organic is, you know, nuts and bolts. Or, you know, maybe it's an organic that is that's derived from an evolution of the human that looks more like a machine.
Wow.
But anyway, sorry.
No. We have to... It's all relevant, and it's all part of this. Thank you so much for being here on DH Radio at CJMQ, Michael Ridley. Again, I'm just going to remind you all, Michael Ridley is Chief Information Officer and Chief Librarian at McLaughlin Library at University of Guelph. Thank you so much for being here, and it's really exciting that you'll be a part of the Living Libraries events going on at the Forman Art Gallery.
Thanks very much. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you.